Thank you, Tanya. Good morning, everyone. Terrific to be with you. This is an audience that has much lived experience with the topic I'd like to address today, the role of uncertainty and risk aversion in decision making. I'll begin with some perspectives on how uncertainty and risk aversion were impacting key parts of the global economy and financial markets in the period between the global financial crisis and the start of the pandemic. I'll then switch gears to discuss how some of these issues may be relevant to the domestic outlook as we emerge from a once-in-a-century shock. Now, uncertainty and risk aversion are difficult concepts to pin down. They can't be observed directly, and they can mean different things in different contexts. Today, I'll discuss uncertainty mostly in the one-sided sense of how people perceive the likelihood of bad outcomes, while referring to risk aversion or animal spirits in relation to how people act in the face of uncertainty. One way to consider it is as follows. Uncertainty reflects perceptions or beliefs, while risk aversion is about behaviours. The bottom line is that when uncertainty and risk aversion are high, the resulting caution by households and firms can drive up savings relative to investment and therefore have important implications for the economy and for asset prices. Now, in the decade or so bookended by the GFC and the onset of the pandemic, some anomalies emerged at the intersection of international macroeconomics and finance. Of most relevance for today's discussion were the following. First, why were neutral interest rates so low, beyond what could be explained by traditional factors like population and potential GDP growth, or the returns to capital? Second, why was capital investment and corporate risk-taking more generally so subdued when profits were high and financing terms were so accommodating? And third, why were investors prepared to pay a premium for so-called safe assets at a time of high corporate profitability and low volatility? Now, there were a number of plausible explanations for these questions in isolation, but my reading was that risk-based explanations had a particularly important role in helping to reconcile all three anomalies, namely, a heightened sense of uncertainty and risk aversion was contributing to an increased desire for saving over investment. As I'll step through in a moment, this affected economic activity and risk premiums in financial markets, particularly in large advanced economies, in unusual ways. When the concept of a neutral rate of interest was introduced more than a century ago, it was thought to be determined by the forces of productivity and thrift. The neutral interest rate is the interest rate that aligns savings with investment and is neither stimulatory nor contractionary for the economy. Over recent decades, it's become an important benchmark around which central banks set monetary policy. But translating the idea of a neutral rate into practical applications is challenging, and there's no single best way to estimate it. For decades up until the GFC, most estimates of the neutral rate in advanced economies track fairly closely to projections of potential GDP growth. That is, R was close to G. But following the global financial crisis, an unusually large and persistent wedge between R and G opened up in major advanced economies. And a broadly similar pattern was also evident in Australia. While slow-moving patterns in demographics and productivity could help to explain the general downtrend in neutral rates over recent decades, they couldn't account for the magnitude of the decline after the global financial crisis. Something, it seemed, had changed. The stubbornly low level of neutral interest rates in the post-GFC period was difficult to reconcile along another dimension. In theory, at least, high returns to capital should strengthen firms' desire for investment relative to saving and therefore raise the neutral rate of interest. But the low level of neutral rates was at odds with the elevated returns to capital generated by firms in many advanced economies in the post-GFC period. Prior to the pandemic, a growing literature began to establish that part of this wedge between neutral rates on the one hand and potential growth or the return to capital on the other could be attributed to elevated uncertainty and risk aversion. To be clear, other factors also likely contributed to the downward trend in neutral rates, but a key takeaway was that for any rate of potential economic growth, neutral rates will be lower when uncertainty and risk aversion is high. Now, a second anomaly in the post-GFC period was subdued risk-taking by firms, principally in large advanced economies. This was despite equity valuations and profits rebounding, estimates of potential growth stabilising, and financing conditions remaining accommodative. This cautiousness found expression in many ways, but perhaps none more so than in the preference for returning cash to shareholders over long-lived capital investment. As a case in point, during the strong US investment cycle of the late 1990s, capital expenditure by firms listed on the S&P 1500 exceeded the combined value of stock buybacks and dividend payments by around 60%. But just prior to the pandemic, this had flipped around, such that spending by these same firms on buybacks and dividends was now more than 1.5 times that on CapEx. As with the decline in neutral rates, a number of factors were likely at play here, but researchers established a key role for uncertainty. The intuition is straightforward. There are a few ways for firms to insure against high uncertainty, and because long-term investment decisions are lumpy and costly to reverse, it can shorten investment horizons or hold back investment entirely. In other words, when uncertainty is high, there is value in firms holding out for more information until the fog is cleared before investing. This can be magnified where shareholders reward company management for adopting risk-averse strategies in response to uncertainty, like prioritising cost control or the return of cash over new investment. As many of you in this audience would be aware, in Australia our experience was a little different to that abroad, in that the period of low capital investment prior to the pandemic was concentrated in non-mining firms as the mining sector embarked on a record level of investment in response to high commodity prices in the years either side of the GFC. Unusually strong demand for safe assets offered another way to view the effects of uncertainty and risk aversion in the years after the global financial crisis. Global investors were prepared to pay a premium to hold liquid and highly rated bonds, as reflected in term premia on sovereign debt turning negative for the first time. Risk premia in plain vanilla corporate credit markets was also unusually low compared to the less liquid and more complex structured credit markets and the more volatile equity markets. And measures of tail risk in equity derivative markets remained persistently high. The anomaly here was that this was a time of generally subdued economic and financial market volatility and healthy corporate profits. Now, new banking regulations and central bank asset purchases clearly contributed to the bid for safe assets over this period, but safe asset demand also reflected investor willingness to pay a premium for the insurance-like properties of liquid and highly rated fixed income securities. And this could be seen in a few ways. First was the shift in risk appetite in large financial institutions. Severe volatility in funding status after the GFC prompted pension funds in large advanced economies, less so here, to increase exposure to fixed income securities with stable cash flows. And bank and non-bank lenders came to place very high value on the collateral and liquidity risk management functions performed by high-quality fixed income securities. Second was the perceived recession hedging properties of sovereign bonds in an environment of low inflation. This perception became ingrained from the late 1990s onwards as stock and bond returns became negatively correlated, most notably during the equity market crashes of 2000 and 2008, when US Treasuries fully offset the decline in equities. Assets that pay off in recessions are highly valuable for their consumption smoothing properties and so can attract demand even at low or negative yields. A third source of safe asset demand, predating the GFC and discussed more in a moment, was connected to the shift in global wealth to investors with relatively high risk aversion. Now, having outlined how uncertainty and risk aversion could have been affecting some key parts of the global economy and financial markets in the decades after the GFC, let me now offer some suggestions as to what may have been behind this. I should be clear that it's not possible to be definitive here, but four candidates seem plausible. First was lingering insecurity stemming from severe crises or rare disasters in key parts of the global economy. Second was fears of a household debt overhang in some large advanced economies in particular. Third, international trade and policy uncertainty. And fourth, the increasing global influence of risk-averse investors. The first of these was the impact on risk perceptions and risk appetite following the severe crises between the late 1990s and the early 2010s. It's possible that by the end of this period, which spanned several emerging market financial crises, the GFC and the euro area debt crisis, that the way the people in the worst affected regions perceive the risk of rare disasters had changed. This connects to a concept that psychologists refer to as dread risk, and what financial economists call rare disaster risk when trying to explain asset price puzzles. The basic idea here is that rare traumatic events that can impact society at large, such as wars, depressions, and financial crises, can leave a lasting and possibly exaggerated sense of fear and insecurity for many years afterwards. The Great Depression offered an early window into this sort of dynamic. In their classic account, Milton Friedman and Anna Swartz documented the intense pessimism among households and businesses that played a key role in explaining not just the severity, but also the persistence of the downturn. Researchers subsequently documented how so-called depression babies and corporate managers of the 1930s were highly risk-averse through their lifetime. Later, business investment was found to remain persistently low in a number of advanced economies following financial crises in the decades prior to the GFC. A similar phenomenon unfolded after the global financial crisis. Another example included the 1987 global stock market collapse, which permanently changed how markets priced the probability of crashes. A decade on, a series of crises in emerging markets prompted some countries to accumulate holdings of foreign reserves that were far in excess of what the IMF deemed necessary for self-insurance purposes. And on a different note, Bob Shiller's analysis suggested that the public tends to believe the probability of large market crashes is much higher than can be supported by the historical data, and that intensive, unbalanced media coverage after rare adverse events can magnify this disconnect. Given the severity of the global financial crisis, it seems at least plausible that it too altered perceptions of and attitudes to risk for a number of years afterward, particularly in the worst affected economies. A second issue that may have been contributing to a heightened sense of uncertainty and risk aversion following the global financial crisis related to fears of a debt overhang among households in some large advanced economies. Some households may have felt uncomfortable that their balance sheets were not as resilient to shocks as they would have liked following the earlier increase in debt. Job insecurity or reduced expectations of wages growth may have contributed to the sense of unease. In aggregate, household sector deleveraging continued for years after the global financial crisis, despite record low interest rates, particularly in large advanced economies most affected by the crisis. Some years after one might have expected the psychological effects of the GFC to be dissipating, another source of uncertainty loomed. News reports and other sources appeared to indicate a substantial increase in global trade and policy uncertainty. This could have reflected any number of developments: intensifying strategic rivalries, trade wars, a resurgence in populism, Brexit, and climate policy uncertainty among them. This uncertainty shock was cited as having a role in depressing business investment, domestically and abroad. That said, it's hard to think that political and trade uncertainty was any higher than, say, in the 1970s, when during the Cold War period, the Bretton Woods exchange rate system unraveled and severe volatility in inflation and oil prices plagued the global economy. A fourth slower-moving factor, either side of the GFC, connected to the growing influence of risk-averse investors, principally central banks in emerging market economies and retirees in advanced economies. Emerging market economies responded to the crises of the late 1990s by saving far more than they invested and consumed. One way to see this was in their central bank reserve holdings increasing from 1.5% to 8% of global GDP, much of which was invested in safe assets. At the same time, the growing share of households in or approaching retirement age in advanced economies had to contend with heightened longevity risk, that is, the risk of running out of savings, as prospective investment returns declined to historically low levels and defined benefit pension schemes came under strain. To hedge against this uncertainty, some households would have seen it as rational to consume less and to save more. Now, it's reasonable to ask here, how might the pandemic connect to the issues experienced in key parts of the global economy in the years beforehand? And what could be some implications for the Australian economy in the period ahead? At face value, the pandemic would seem to have all the hallmarks of a classic rare disaster. The international experience might suggest that this could have lasting effects on perceptions of risk and animal spirits here too in Australia. While it is encouraging that measures of global economic policy uncertainty have receded over recent times, it is at least possible that some Australian households and firms seek to repair their balance sheets for a considerable period, as occurred in a number of other advanced economies after the GFC. In recognition of this possibility, a downside scenario for the domestic economy was outlined in the bank's recent set of forecasts published in the May Statement on Monetary Policy. This scenario reflected a situation where private consumption and business investment remained subdued in the years ahead, partly due to lingering uncertainty and insecurity. With households preferring to direct more of their income to strengthening their balance sheets, including by paying down debt, private consumption and investment would be weak. In turn, unemployment would remain above pre-pandemic levels and inflation would remain low over the next few years. And in countries that have been more severely affected by the pandemic than Australia, it could be the case that a high degree of caution lingers for some years. But there are at least two material differences between the current episode and past severe shocks that point to a brighter outlook in Australia. First, the origins of this shock have been substantially different from rare disasters of the past. The contraction last year was precipitated by a severe and sudden supply shock, where a global health crisis necessitated state-mandated shutdowns of significant parts of the global and domestic economies. Restrictions on consumption contributed to the increase in household savings across income cohorts in Australia, and a similar pattern has been observed globally. Large-scale disruptions of this nature distinguish the current episode from past global crises, where private demand and often parts of the financial system crumbled under the weight of years of accumulating imbalances involving too much debt and inflated asset prices. These same factors weighed on post-crisis recoveries for years. But reflecting the unique nature of the COVID-19 shock, The recent experience domestically and abroad has been that economic activity has snapped back after restrictions have been lifted. Indeed, the speed of the recovery in activity and the labour market in Australia bears little resemblance to past downturns, as shown here. This should give us some hope that less economic scarring will result. A second reason why the path ahead may be different from typical post-crisis recoveries is because many Australian household and business balance sheets are in better shape than before the pandemic. This is the result of the unusual size and composition of the policy response in Australia. The increase in household income during the pandemic is unprecedented as far as past downturns go, and policy has also supported business balance sheets through a difficult period. One implication is that it is possible many Australian households and businesses feel more financially secure than is typically the case after a severe shock. Precautionary behaviour could therefore be less of a drag on the economy. On this note, it has been encouraging to see consumer and business confidence bounce back strongly, and fewer Australian firms report that economic uncertainty is affecting investment plans compared to earlier in the pandemic. The possibility that private consumption and investment could pick up even more strongly in the period ahead than our baseline forecast suggests is reflected in the upside scenario in the May Statement of Monetary Policy. It envisages households substantially increasing spending, partly as they feel more secure about the recovery. A key question here is whether households, having survived the worst of the pandemic in reasonable financial shape, embark on a period of unusually strong so-called revenge consumption, supported by their significant savings from last year and higher asset prices. Private investment and employment would likely be stronger in such a scenario, with higher income spurring on stronger consumption and investment in a reinforcing cycle. Now, were this to eventuate, the unemployment rate would decline at a faster pace and to a lower level than assumed in the baseline scenario, and inflation would pick up more rapidly. So in conclusion, I've suggested that risk-based issues were among those contributing to the increased appetite for saving over investment globally before the pandemic. There are reasons to suspect that uncertainty and risk aversion could continue to have an important bearing on the global outlook as we emerge from the shadow of a once-in-a-century shock. Here in Australia, it would seem premature to completely rule out the possibility of an overhang of cautious behaviour by households and firms, as seen internationally following previous shocks like the Great Depression and the global financial crisis. However, the unusual origins of the COVID-19 shock and the fact that in Australia at least, many household and business balance sheets are in better condition today than they were before the pandemic suggest the domestic economy could follow a quite different trajectory compared to past rare disasters experienced abroad. Indeed, this is consistent with our central scenario for the Australian economy and the surprising strength in the domestic recovery to date. Thank you.